The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Argonaut Insurance Company versus Debbie Baker from Dallas County, Hilco Electric Cooperative, Hilco United Services versus Midlothian Butane Gas Company from Hill County, and Walmart Stores Incorporated versus Monroe Johnson and others from Jefferson County. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument in each of these causes. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and complete the arguments before lunch. We are recording these arguments, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee from the court. We are ready to hear argument from petitioner in Argonaut versus Baker.
May it please the court, Mr. Scott A. Whistler and Ms. Amy Maddox will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Whistler will open the first 12 minutes. Ms. Maddox will be speaking for 3 minutes, and Mr. Whistler will present the rebuttal.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Scott Whistler. Jim Grau and I, with the firm of Grau, Ashley & Cohen, represent petitioner Argonaut Insurance Company in this lawsuit. Amy Maddox is with Baker Botts. She is representing the amicus briefer, Reliant Energy. She represents an employer with a deductible workers' compensation policy for asking something to say on the issues before the court today. Argonaut seeks reversal of the decision of the Dallas Court of Appeals, in this case, a decision that is apparently based on an exception to the subrogation rules in the workers' compensation context, an exception that it is our contention does not exist. It's an exception that is at odds with the statutory subrogation scheme as laid out in the statutes. It's an exception that's at odds with the terms of the insurance contract between the parties in this case. It's an exception that is at odds with the public policy supporting the subrogation scheme. And it's an exception at odds with the history of this court's rulings in the subrogation context. The holding of the Dallas Court of Appeals is as follows, that an insurer under a deductible workers' compensation policy that pays benefits under that plan to an injured employee has no right to reimbursement for the benefits paid unless and until and only to the extent that the insurance benefits that are paid exceed the deductible or the amount of the deductible under the policy. Now that's a sharp, sharp departure from the rule. This court has for years, and the statutes for years have supported a subrogation scheme that is as follows, that the insurer is subrogated to the rights of the employee for the amount of benefits paid, period.
That the insurer's subrogation for me, how does this mechanically work as far as benefits being paid to a covered worker as between the employer and the carrier? And what it sounds like a simple way is if they have a $250,000 deductible, that the employer should be paying the benefits up to that, and then the carrier steps in after it. But apparently that's not the way it works.
If this were in the self-insurance context, that is the way it often works. But these deductible plans, excuse me, are not in that sense pure self-insurance. Mm-hmm. The insurer, under the contract and under the statute, is required to pay the benefits up front.
And seek reimbursement of the deductible from the employer.
Yes.
And at what point does the employer make the periodic payments? Do they do that on a monthly basis, a quarterly basis? How does that work?
From the statute, it's not clear. It's not clear that I've seen from the regulations. I think
is
the
there anything in the record that reflects how it worked in this instance?
Not in this instance, because there have been no payments. It's my understanding yet that the insurer has not gone back to the employer to seek reimbursement, because in a sense, Argonaut stands here today also in the shoes of Flowers Construction in the, under the contract.
Well, then that makes the problem, at least the argument from the other side, that the employer does not have a statutory subrogation right, and but the insurance carrier does. And so the insurance carrier appears as an intervener urging 100% subrogation right of totally what they paid out. And then comes the fuzzy part. If they can get $250,000 from the employer, but they get $302,000 out of the settlement proceeds, somebody's ending up with a double recovery, it sounds like.
There's clearly a double recovery, especially well, then,
why? Tell me how we can write a rule that avoids the double recovery.
Well, the double recovery can be avoided simply by allowing the workers' compensation benefits and recovery process to proceed as it always has, with the insurer, the subrogation rights of the insurer being recognized as accruing at the time that a claim for benefits is made. And recognizing
if,
that the insurer...
If you do not recover the $250,000 from the employee, then the employer is responsible for the $250,000 self-insured deductible.
Well...
Correct? I mean, the insurance company's not going to be out anything here.
I would agree with the second statement, but the premise...
I understand, we're trying to understand where the money goes.
Okay.
If you lose this lawsuit... then the $250,000 will come out of the employer's pocket and go to the insurance carrier.
That is correct.
So the insurance carrier is not at this point in time or will not be at any point in time during the course of this litigation out the $250,000.
As long as the employer
is solvent. So what the insurance carrier is trying to do at this point in time is assert subrogation rights that will allow that $250,000 to be paid out of the employee's proceeds of the claim against a third party rather than out of the employer.
And with that,
and
we disagree.
As a result of that, this is why your opponents in the lawsuit are claiming that it runs afoul of the statutory scheme, because the statutory scheme prohibits the employer from getting its deductible in any way from the employee.
That is their argument, Your Honor.
And so at bottom, this case is a statutory interpretation case.
Well, it is a statutory interpretation case.
That's what we have to do in this case, is interpret the statute and determine whether or not the statute allows the employer to basically be relieved of its obligation to pay the deductible as a result of sums that are paid by the employee.
Well, Your Honor, we would disagree with the premise of the question.
Okay.
The question is... has the legislature, it is a statutory construction question.
Okay.
The question is, has the legislature, by introducing deductible plans and making them available, have they changed the way in which subrogation rights accrue to insurers? There's no indication by the enactment of...
If they do have a statutory provision, however, that indicates that the employer may not look to the employee for the deductible, and in fact, they may very well have done that.
We disagree with that, Your Honor, for this reason, that it is not logical under this court's interpretation and the historical statutory interpretation of the way subrogation rights accrue to insurers to suggest that the employee is paying this money, because the cases and the statutes have said that the money belongs to the insurer to the extent of benefits paid, and that the employee has no rights.
But again,
has no rights to recover.
But again, this depends on where we start. If the question is a statutory interpretation question, then we must ascertain what the legislature meant when it put in the workers' compensation statute the provisions applicable to these self-insured deductibles. And in fact, what that means. And if that governs, you're starting from the standpoint of let's look at what subrogation law is and make sure that particular aspect of the law is fulfilled here. So the starting point makes a big difference in this case. And your opponent starts with a statute. You start with subrogation law.
Well, I say let's start from the same place, which is, has the legislature changed the rule? There's no dispute between the parties that the general rule is that an insurer's subrogation rights accrue upon the claim, and that it equals the amount of benefits paid. So the question is, did the legislature make an exception where there are deductible plans?
Mr. Levenger says, yes, they did. And they did it with the language in the statute which says that the employer cannot look to the employee. And since this is money out of the employee's pocket, to do this would run afoul of that statutory scheme. And what is your response to that?
My response is that 5.55C mm-hmm. and the institution of that rule and the promulgation of these deductible policies did not change the language of Labor Code 417.001, 417.002. It did not override this court's rules and understanding of subrogation law in the statutory context. That's what's required in order to get to where Mr. Levenger wants to go.
What does the exception mean then?
What does the exception mean that as the Dallas Court of Appeals? Well, it in effect turns the subrogation rules on its head.
No,
it
sir. My question is, how do we give meaning to the provision that the employer cannot look to the employee? How do we give meaning to that provision of the workers' compensation law?
The meaning is by recognizing the evil that the legislature was aiming to protect the employees from, which is employers who are ultimately forced to pay deductibles or other expenses or want to try and pass on other costs to the employees are prohibited from doing so.
Well, but that's what I understand Mr. Levenger says is happening in this case. So, again, my question goes back to that language seems pretty clear and it's plain language. What does it mean if it doesn't mean that the employee cannot be required to pay the employer?
It only makes sense to our mind for Mr. Levenger to make that argument if, in fact, the rules have changed and the insurer's subrogation rights do not accrue upon the payment of benefits.
Well, let me ask you about rules changing. Just to argue this, if the employer self-insures for, $250,000 and then has a policy that covers above $250,000, can the employer then subrogate to the employees? If the employer pays for these benefits, now can the employer then argue that it's entitled to subrogation from the employee if the employee gets a recovery against a third party?
Well,
if the employer is covering this up to the first $250,000.
If we're talking the pure self-insurance context, I'm not sure how that works. There isn't an identical provision, for instance, a 5.55C that goes to self-insurance plans. This is a deductible plan, which means that, by definition, the insurer is fronting the money. The carrier is required to service the claims under the statute, is required to put out the money, is then required under the contract to, on behalf of the employer and the employee, seek recoupment from responsible third parties if possible, apply the received monies against the outlay, and then, if the insurance company is paid back, then some can be credited to the employer's deductible. But that's an important point, Your Honor, that under the contract, the definition of the deductible turns out to be what is left over after the insurance company has gone out and done its contractual job, which is to seek recovery from the
responsible
party.
So what employers ought to do, maybe I don't have this quite right, but what employers ought to do is not do any sort of self-insuring. What they ought to do is get a large deductible. What they really ought to do is a big deductible, and then they will always be able to get in a third-party context, where the employee goes out and gets a recovery against a third party, then the employer can get their deductible back.
I don't agree the Dallas
deductible issue, like you say here, then they can make sure that they're paid back for their deductible in a third-party context. And you don't, and there's nothing in the statute that indicates that the legislature didn't want the employee to have to foot the bill for the deductible.
I see nothing in the statute to suggest that the legislature wanted to change the way in which the parties went after the responsible third parties. They want there to be an incentive for the injured employee as well as the carrier to go after those responsible parties, and then only after that to look to the employer. I mean, the whole idea behind the introduction of these plans is the cost factor. This history of workers' compensation in this state is the expense, and the rising expense of these type of insurance plans, which are being mandated to employers, is high, and it's prohibitive.
But why doesn't this, as the Court of Appeals said, and as one of the amicus briefs points out, result in a windfall to the employer? Because the employer, the economics behind this are to allow the employer to reduce significantly the cost of insurance. And my understanding in this case that ordinarily the premium would have been somewhere between $400,000 and $500,000 a year, and instead the company paid somewhere $100,000+ for the premium. By taking this kind of plan and doing one of these negotiable self-insured deductibles where they negotiate for a large amount of the deductible. So there has been there's a significant economic savings to the employer for this that they have benefited by undertaking this responsibility to pay the deductible, the first $250,000. So if we approach it from the standpoint that you do, that we have to protect the whole economics of it, then aren't we undercutting the scheme that's been in place? Because, in fact, we're now asking the employee to foot the bill, and, in fact, the employer now gets the benefit of the reduced premium without having to come out of pocket for the larger deductible, which is what they negotiated for.
Your Honor, I'm out of time.
Go ahead.
Time to respond. Thank you. The assumption is correct that the employer has taken on a larger risk by virtue of the deductible, but has not taken on the risk. It's a different risk and a more subtle risk than what is being defined by the Dallas Court of Appeals, because the risk that they took on is the deductible minus what could be recovered from the responsible third parties whenever possible.
Well, in this particular instance, and you mentioned earlier double recovery, we don't have an employer getting a double recovery here. In fact, we have a seriously injured employee who has, as I understand it, permanent injuries, permanent serious brain injuries, and in fact, his recovery may not have, in fact, taken care of all of his needs. So we're not in a situation, we're not in that kind of a situation where we've got a double recovery, where he's got insurance proceeds and for the exact same piece, he's also getting recovery from a third party.
I would disagree, Your Honor. That's exactly what we have. That the claims that were being made against the responsible third party in the underlying case were based on the same medical damage and the same injury for which they had received benefits.
I understand that, but what the briefing indicates and what I understand from in the record in this case indicates that the amount that was that of the settlement with the third party was affected by the limits on the insurance coverage, which was somewhere in the neighborhood of $800,000+. But in fact, the damages may have exceeded that.
My understanding, Your Honor, is that the term double recovery has a slightly different meaning in the workers' compensation context. As one of the important policies behind the subrogation scheme, the idea is that whenever possible, the insurer gets paid back first. That's the overriding principle. That's different than in a common law equitable subrogation, where the rule is, as you suggest, that there is no right to subrogation until the injured party has been made whole.
But the point is that the context in which we've talked about double recovery in this implies that, in fact, the employee has recovered more money than would be necessary to compensate him for the injury that he sustained, and that's not, in fact, the case here.
I would submit, Your Honor, that in the workers' compensation context, double recovery always means that the employee has been able to keep...
But my point is that to imply that the employee has gotten more money than was necessary to compensate for him his damages may not be accurate in this case.
Well, I don't know that we have an argument, and I don't on that issue, and I don't think that is the issue in terms of what a double recovery is.
Mr. Whistler, I just have one quick question.
Yes, sir.
It seems that there are good policy arguments on either side of this issue. Both parties have put forth, I think, compelling arguments as to their different interpretations of the statute. And that being the case, isn't that just the type of thing we leave to the legislature to weigh these policy concerns, and that they did that in enacting 5.55C? it's hard to get around the plain language of the statute. Reliant, I think, in their amicus brief says that really the intent of the statute was not to allow wage withholding for payment of the premium, but that's really sort of created out of whole cloth. We don't have any legislative history or anything else except the plain language of the statute. Is that right?
Well, there is a legislative context in this where it's clear that the issue that is being addressed, attempted to be addressed by the deductible plans, was, again, the high cost of workers' compensation
insurance. To lower the premiums, and how do we know that the quid pro quo wasn't then to put the burden of the deductible on the employer?
Well, I guess it's not clear, and I guess that is the argument.
And my point exactly, it's not clear, and with it not being clear, don't we have to just rely on the plain meaning of the statute?
Well, what's not clear is that the legislature intended the sea change that is being suggested by the Dallas opinion. There's no indication anywhere that for this very small area of deductible plans that the legislature intended to turn the subrogation scheme on its head and put the employees in front of the insurers.
But what did they intend by it is my question. I hear you, but why did they do it?
They intended by 5.55C to prohibit, to deter those employers who, at the end of the day, after benefits were paid, and if there is no recovery available against third parties that would satisfy the deductible.
But there's nothing in the statute that so limits it. That makes eminent sense to me.
I understand.
But there's nothing to limit it. In fact, wasn't a bill proposed to make that more specific that was then rejected?
I believe that there was some language in committee that never made it out of committee.
And so, again, we're back to the plain meaning. We can posit possibilities for different reasons for things, but really we're stuck with the plain language of the statute.
We're stuck with the plain language of the statute, but we're also stuck with the legislature's understanding of the way the world was when they enacted this law. And the way the world was when they enacted this law is that insurers, by virtue of 417.01 and 002, when a claim is made, their rights accrue. They made no change to that.
Well, and if that was the intent, then there would be no reason for 5.55C.
No, there still is a reason, because there still is the risk that after benefits are paid and after the insurer and the plaintiff go after the responsible third party, recover money, and there isn't enough money to credit it back to cover the deductible, the insurer is going to go after that employer for that money. And that's where the pressure to the employees and the prohibition lies, to going back to the employee.
You'd agree that that would be fairly easy to say.
I think that's exactly what they said here.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the amicus.
Please, the court. Mr. Jeff Levenger will present argument.
We're not quite there.
Sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have one primary point to make on behalf of the employers who have these sorts of large deductible insurance policy, and that is that in opting for these workers' comp policies with a deductible, the employers did not in any way bargain that they would be responsible for the acts of third-party tortfeasors over whom they have absolutely no control. And the idea that that is what they bargained for is negated both by the express language of the contracts that they enter into, which are approved and must be approved by the insurance board, and also by the legislative scheme. The legislative scheme, as Mr. Whistler indicated, had been set in Texas workers' compensation law for a long time, and there is no intent to change that. And in fact, when the legislature enacted 5.55C, which the entirety of the statute of that section requires these sorts of policies, it did not change the subrogation law. It was working against the context of the general rule that an employee's right to recovery for a third party is subrogated to, and that employee does not have rights until the subrogation interest is satisfied for the third-party recovery. And the way this works is that under the policy, and the statute requires that the policy read this way, the carrier is responsible for all benefits that are paid. That includes the deductible amount. And then Labor Code 417.002 states that the subrogation interest, the recovery from the third party, shall be used to reimburse the carrier for the benefits paid. So working against that scheme, there's no indication that subsection F of 5.55C is designed to do anything rather than prevent an employer from doing what it must.
We have two other provisions in the statute that we have to look to in this context, but let me start by asking you, if the employees, the proceeds that the employee received from the third party, the $250,000, are not paid to the carrier, then in fact the employer is going to be paying the $250,000 in this case.
If the
employer will have to pay the deductible then.
Right.
Okay. So the insurance carrier is not going to be paying the deductible under any circumstances.
The
amount that is attributable to the deductible.
No, the insurance carrier is responsible under the policy to go after it, and the way the policies work is that the first money that the insurance carrier receives has to go to the carrier for benefits that the carrier has paid, and if anything has been paid by the employer, it's the deductible because it is a periodic reimbursement, then it goes to the employer.
So the carrier could be passing through some of the money the carrier could be passing through some of the money to the employer.
Correct.
And if in fact the $250,000 is not recovered from the proceeds of a lawsuit against a third party, then the employer will be responsible for the entire $250,000.
Correct.
All right. But we have two provisions of the statute that are at play here. One, the one that we've been talking about how the employee cannot be held responsible. But the other provision of the statute that does not include the employer who is under one of these plans as a party who has any subrogation right. So, in fact, if that's the circumstance, then how can the carrier proceed to recover that $250,000 that is, in fact, the legal responsibility of the employer?
Your Honor, I think that that's exactly what the statute says. That's the way the legislature has decided it should work. And the legislature could
have. No, but my question is that there is a provision that says who can assert subrogation rights and who has them, and it does not include an employer under one of these plans.
That's correct, and that's why Argonaut is the party in this case, because it's their responsibility.
But I understand that, but doesn't that in some way limit the right of Argonaut to go forward to recover that $250,000 that in turn would be actually for the benefit of the employer?
We respectfully disagree because...
What is the meaning of that then?
The meaning is that the legislature has said that the carrier pays all the benefits, and that the carrier is reimbursed for all benefits paid. And has also designated the insurance board to approve all policy language. And under the policy language...
But if the policy language is contrary to the statute, then the statute is going to prevail.
The statute will prevail if it's contrary, but the agency construction is eminently reasonable with this.
No, I understand, but we still have to look at the statute.
Of course.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Jeff Levenger will now present argument for the respondents.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I think the biggest problem with both the positions we've heard is that they're trying to treat optional deductible insurance policies just like any other kind of workers' compensation insurance. But in fact, optional deductible plans are very different. They're different as a matter of statutory treatment, and they're different as a matter of economics. And I think in this case, the employer actually even comes out ahead under the Court of Appeals ruling. And the problem is, unless these differences are appreciated, the injured workers will be forced to bear the costs of workers' compensation insurance, which has always been impermissible. I'd like to first start with this first money paid theory that we've heard. As to the deductible amount, the first money paid theory just doesn't work as a matter of either insurance code interpretation or even the labor code interpretation. I think it's very useful to look at it from the standpoint of the three parties in this triangle. From the standpoint of the insurance carrier, Section 417 would apply when the insurer needs to be reimbursed for the money that's paid out in benefits. But as to the benefits corresponding to the deductible, it does not need to be reimbursed. Now, why is that? It's because of Article 5.55CD. And I think this kind of goes to Justice Rodriguez's question. The way it works is that even though the insurance carrier is supposed to advance the money, it actually writes the check for the benefits, it is required to get that money on a periodic basis from the policyholder. In fact, the language is very explicit under 5.55D. It says reimbursement by the policyholder shall be made periodically rather than at the time claim costs are incurred. So it's not some let's wait and see what happens with respect to a third-party recovery. The reimbursement payments are supposed to be made by the policyholder, by the insured employer, on a periodic basis. And when that happens, there's nothing that the insurance carrier needs to be reimbursed with respect to that deductible, that $250,000. That's why the general statutory subrogation provision, 417, does not apply with respect to the deductible amount.
Can you tell me why you say the employer is ahead in this case? Because I read all the amicus briefs, and the other side is saying that if we rule your way, that these optional deductible plans will just go out the window because they will be totally undermined.
I think that concern is greatly exaggerated, Justice O'Neill, because let's look at the numbers in this case. Here, Flowers bargained for a $250,000 deductible. In return, it got a substantial premium credit. I think the record shows, as Justice Hankinson said, somewhere in the neighborhood of $420,000. So if it has to pay out the $250,000, but at the same time it's received a premium credit of $420,000, it still comes out ahead by $170,000.
Well, it's just done this one case.
With respect to this one accident.
Well,
that's
but
true.
Presumably it has other cases. That's why you have insurance.
Right.
When somebody's paying $400,000 for insurance and only getting $100,000 of relief, they're going to quit buying insurance or go to another provider.
Yeah, of course, the record here doesn't say what else this
well, but it doesn't make any sense to say they made money on this if you're paying more in premiums than you're getting in alleviation of risk, you're going to quit paying the premium.
Well, it's not so much a question of making money, Justice Hecht. It's a question of allocating risk. And my point is simply they have understood what the risks are going to be at the outset. They bargained for a high deductible, $250,000, in exchange for substantial premium credits here, somewhere in the neighborhood of $420,000.
But the argument is they didn't understand it was going to be at the expense of whatever could be recovered in subrogation if an employee was injured by a third party.
Well, they should have understood that because an employer has no, a self-insured deductible employer has no statutory subrogation rights. We need to remember.
But if they're telling the truth and they didn't understand it, they're going to be less likely to buy deductible policies, or else they're going to be less likely to pay that much for them. They might as well buy a full policy.
Well, I don't think so because of the nature of the size of the premiums. But at the same time, if they wanted statutory subrogation rights under Section 417, an employer should become a certified self-insurer. Here they're not a certified self-insurer.
That argument says that deductibles are not as good a deal as the legislature thought they would, and therefore you ought to take another option that the legislature provided.
Well, my point is simply if the employer wants statutory subrogation rights, he shouldn't become an optional deductible employer because they have no statutory subrogation rights. They may have common law rights of equitable subrogation, which is different. But they do not have statutory subrogation rights. They cannot make a claim to the first money paid. They may have a claim under equitable subrogation where the presumption is flipped. That is, the first dollars go to the employee until the employee is made whole.
This seems a little weird because, as I understand the argument, if this employer had bought a full policy without a deductible, the plaintiff would get less. No question.
Well, that would be true because we'd have Section 417 regard to the Article 5.5.
So if he buys a deductible, then more is paid out.
Well, it's just a function of Article 5.55C, D, and F. D, which says that the employer has to make periodic reimbursement, and F, which says, I think unequivocally, the employee shall not be made to pay any of the deductible.
But I'm having trouble understanding a statutory scheme that provides fewer benefits to an injured worker depending as long as the employer pays more in premiums. If he buys a full policy and there's no deductible, so he pays a higher premium, he's out the money and the employee's out the money. So why would they do that?
Well, there are not a lot of self-insured, there are not a lot of optional deductible plans out there. They only make up less than, I think, 2% of all policies in the state, and it's even a smaller percentage when you look at the large negotiated deductibles. So there really aren't very many of them. I can't explain the statutory difference other than just to say that if you don't have the additional features of Article 5.55 in a straightforward normal policy with a large premium and no optional deductible.
Why is the language of the statute so clear that we should ignore the agency's interpretation?
Well, I'm not sure there is an agency interpretation, Justice Phillips. We don't. All we have is an amicus, which I think it was Safeco, which submitted a blurb out of a workers' compensation manual. And I'm not sure that's an agency interpretation to start with. But even if it
what
were...
What more would it take?
I'm sorry?
What more would it take to be an agency interpretation? Formal
well,
or reg?
Or? I would think so.
Who
something in the administrative
the
code.
Who
sorry?
Prepares the manuals?
It's just unclear. There's
what
one page
could
attached
you assume
to the amicus
it's
brief.
Workers' Compensation Commission that prepares the manual so their people will know how to talk to the insurance carriers?
That may be, Justice Speaker.
I don't know.
No, I don't
there's another something else that bothers me. There's no dispute that Mr. Baker's got $352,000 worth of benefits paid for
right.
by the carrier.
Correct.
And that fact was known when the settlement was being discussed. They were already interveners, and the arguments made, well, you can't require the employee to pay the $250,000 benefits back to the employer because of 55C, D, and F.
Right.
But how is it that he already knows that he's received $352,000 of benefits, which he's going to settle? Because there's somebody that's already paid him that money out of whatever settlement they make with the third party.
Well, don't presume that the settlement from the third party covered the same items as the benefits received.
Well,
from
but
the
my question is, when you have a known liability to a third party subrogated entity, and you settle the case, are you saying that the $882,000 did not include any payment for medical benefits previously received or incurred by the Bakers?
That would be my position, given the
and how
size
can you
of the
show that?
Damages.
How can you show that?
Well, to be
or
sure,
did you show that?
To be sure, there's not a tremendous amount in the record. I don't think it matters as a matter of statutory interpretation.
But one of the things that's the problem here is every way you turn when you try to construe these statutes together, it looks like somebody's getting paid twice. If you let the employee keep the whole money without any subrogation, then he's received $352,000 of benefits and another $882,000, and the argument's made that's $1.3 million. And the carrier and the employer are sitting there having paid it with no reimbursement. And so that the employee gets paid twice for the same thing. And that presumes, I guess, that the medical benefits or whatever else were received is part of the settlement funds.
I think there are probably three answers to your mm-hmm. question, Justice Baker, two of a legal nature and one of a factual nature. I think one answer that's overlooked is that in the case of a true double recovery on behalf of the employee, where the amounts he receives both from the insurance company and third party exceed the amount of his losses, that can be handled through equitable subrogation.
Tell me how that works.
Well, equitable, common law equitable subrogation is simply a situation where the payor can get reimbursed, but it's subject to the right of the employee to be made whole first from all of its sources.
Is there any authority for that? I mean, I would think that there wouldn't be any right of subrogation here at all, except that the statute creates it.
Well, there is no right of statutory subrogation, at least with respect to the deductible, but I don't see any impediment necessarily to the assertion of equitable subrogation. There may be defenses to that, but it's part of the weighing of
that. By the employer or the insurance company?
Could be either one. It should be on behalf of the employer, because under 5.55C(d), the presumption is that the employer has already reimbursed that deductible to the insurance carrier. I think another answer to the double recovery is informed by a very recent U.S. Supreme Court opinion that came down in January of this year. It's called Great West Life versus Knudsen. It's 151 LF 2nd 635. It's not really on point, but I think it's instructive. There, the issue is whether the ERISA statute allowed an insurer to come in and claim the benefits out of a third-party recovery. And the Supreme Court held that ERISA did not allow such rights. It allowed only an equitable relief, even though the effect of that ruling was essentially to give a double recovery to the employee. The dissent noted that there was some unjust enrichment. So I think what we have was a case where the U.S. Supreme Court interpreted a statute irrespective of the fact that maybe one impact was to give the employee a double recovery.
But that cuts against what you just said. You said your first position is we don't have to worry about that because we can deal with it by equitable estoppel. Your second position is there's no such thing.
Well,
and we should just live with it. So it looks to me like one and two are in some conflict.
I don't think they're exactly in conflict, Your Honor, because my second point deals more with a matter of statutory interpretation. I think the Court of Appeals got it exactly right when he said the issue is not who may receive a windfall, but rather who must bear the burden of the deductible, and that's what the legislature set out. That's what I think is instructive about the Knudsen case.
But assuming that I agree with that would be instructive, and that's what this statute also contemplates, how could you have equitable estoppel?
Well,
or equitable subrogation, or equitable anything.
Right. Again, I think Knudsen is somewhat instructive on that because it said even though you don't have statutory rights to subrogation, there may be other ways in which you can recoup back the money from the employee.
Endorsement that deals with the deductible to the policy design, this is a standard form promulgated by some state agency or not?
I'm not sure how standard it is, Your Honor, because I notice the Reliance policy doesn't quite read the same way.
It's approved by the insurance commission.
It should be, but I'm talking specifically about the language that talks about how if there's a third-party recovery.
Right. That's what I'm getting at.
It's not standard as between those two different policies that I've seen. There are only just two in the record, Reliant and Argonauts, and they don't read the same way. Argonauts says, we, Argonauts, have your Flowers rights to subrogate. And my answer to that is, Flowers has no statutory rights to
subrogate. It says, if we advance any recovery or payment, then the amount we recover will be first applied to the excess of the deductible, and the remainder will be applied to reduce the deductible amount paid by you. And so is that language approved by any state authority or not?
One would think it must be under 5.56, but I come back to the general law that says that the statutes control over the language of the contract. And if they've been getting it wrong all these years in the face of the statute, then the policy language has to yield to the statute. And that's what I'm asserting here. To the extent that language is inconsistent with 5.55.
I'm just trying to get who approves this.
I would think presumably that the insurance commission does under 5.56, but I simply note that the policies aren't even standard with respect to their own language. I don't think Argonaut's policy, for example, extends statutory subrogation rights on behalf of either the insurance carrier or the employer, for that matter.
Do other states offer these optional deductible plans?
I've seen a study, Your Honor, that some 43 of them do, but they're all fairly recent creations.
Have they confronted any of these states a similar issue?
Not that I know of. A lot of the states have similar statutes to 5.55 which say that employees shall not be made to pay any of the deductible, yet I've not seen any judicial interpretation one way or the other.
Now, let me ask you, under the workers' compensation scheme, was there a statutory provision that prohibited the employer from deducting from an employee's pay a pro rata share of the premiums for the workers' compensation coverage?
There is.
Some sort of statute.
I think it's Section 415.
So then they go to a deductible policy. I assume the statute then says you can't charge them for the premiums. So was it necessary for the legislature under a deductible policy to put in a provision to say you can't charge them also for the deductible?
I think so, because...
But there'd be no charge for a deductible unless there was a claim for an injury, right? I mean, how does a deductible get charged to an employee but for the fact that an employee has made a claim against the policy that then invokes the liability of the employer to pay deductible?
That's when it would trigger. But in response to, this maybe doesn't exactly answer your question, but in response to the argument here that what 5.55CF simply means is that it can't come out of the employee's wages, in circumstances where there's either no third-party recovery.
Would it make sense, now, assuming there's no third-party action, and so there's just benefits paid to the employee for the injury, there's no claim of third-party wrongdoing here, the employer, I mean, absent that statute that says you can't charge for the deductible, would the employer have been free to simply do a one-for-one charge unless there was a claim for an injury, right? I mean, how does a deductible get charged to an employee but for the fact that an employee has made a claim against the policy that then invokes the liability of the employer to pay deductible?
That's when it would trigger. But in response to... This maybe doesn't exactly answer your question, but in response to the argument here that what 5.55CF simply means is that it can't come out of the employee's wages in circumstances where there's either no third-party recovery.
Would it make sense, now, assuming there's no third-party action, and so there's just benefits paid to the employee for the injury, there's no claim of third-party wrongdoing here, the employer... I mean, absent that statute that says you can't charge for the deductible, $250,000 versus $100,000, therefore we don't have to pay.
I mean, do a one-for-one charge.
Absent this provision that says that the employer cannot charge the employee for the deductible, is there no other provision in the statute that would have prohibited the employer from refusing to pay the insurance on behalf of the employee because the employer would otherwise have been free to charge back against the employee the deductible?
I think that's exactly the point of 5.55CF, to make sure that employers can't shift the costs of paying the deductible, that optional deductible, onto the employee.
The statute could also reasonably be read to shift it onto the third party. I mean, if you read it literally, it's talking about you can't make the employee pay the deductible, but here you're making a third party pay the deductible.
Well, the third party always pays, but I think
not
the common... Well, but it does, because the common and ordinary usage of the word pay has to mean that if at the end of the day, when I, the injured employee, get my distribution from the settlement, and $250,000 is taken out of it, I'm being made to pay that deductible.
But it's actually being paid by the third party.
The third party pays all the damages.
Well, but you've already gotten the $250,000 from the carrier. That money's already in your pocket, isn't it? So if you say I should get another $250,000, you've been double paid on those benefits.
Well, I disagree with that premise, Your Honor, because at least in this case, there's no evidence that they got their past wages and their medical benefits paid twice. It didn't happen. But I think you are.
A query I would make: when the Bakers sue the third party, usually plaintiffs ask for a recovery of whatever medical benefits have been incurred or amounts have been incurred pre-trial, post-medical pain and suffering, etc. Isn't that correct? And didn't they ask for the same thing here?
Sure. And when they get more money out of the third party, then that works as an advance under 417.002B against future payments by Argonaut with respect to both medical benefits and lost wages.
What's disturbing is, with all that known and that kind of a lawsuit pending and the settlements made, that in effect you're saying we're not going to be cognizant of any outstanding obligations for past medical payments to any third party, except in this case $102,000 over and above, but you've already gotten $250,000.
Well, I think that...
Is there something wrong with repaying everybody that you were, quote, indebted to for previous benefits? What do you settle for, except for this statutory scheme that we're trying to work on?
Well, I think it's the statutory scheme that makes all the difference, Justice Baker, because under the Court of Appeals ruling, we have it sorts out exactly the way it should. The insurer, Argonaut, recoups everything. Every benefit it paid out, it recoups. The employee is not made to pay the deductible when it comes out of the settlement distribution. And at the end of the day, the employer bears the burden of the deductible that it bargained for. It bargained for a relatively high deductible in exchange for a premium credit. And that's exactly the way it sorts out in the Court of Appeals opinion.
Mr. Levenger, when you started your argument, you said that the optional deduction plans are different first as a matter of statute. And you mentioned two points. First of all, the no need for reimbursement of the carrier because the payments are periodic. And second of all, that the employer has no subrogation rights for the deductible. What other features make an optional deductible plan different by statute than the more traditional scheme?
I think the two main ones, Justice Hankinson, would be 5.55CD, the periodic reimbursement, and then 5.55CF, you may not look to the employee to reimburse the deductible. And then, of course, the fact that under Section 417 of the Labor Code, an optional deductible employer is not included within the definition of the word insurance carrier.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Whistler, do you agree that absent the provision that says the employer cannot seek reimbursement of the deductible from the employee, that the employer under these policies would have the right to charge against the employee liability for payment of the medical bills and all that up to the level of deductible? I have a deductible, it's $250,000. The employee goes in the hospital, has $100,000 in damages, comes out, makes a claim for insurance coverage, and absent this provision, under the statutory scheme, the employer would be free to recoup all that medical from the employee.
Absent the prohibition?
Absent this specific prohibition that the employer could have gone against the employee to recoup all this money. And I'm not talking about any sort of third-party action. It's just strictly, I buy comp insurance for my employees. I have a $250,000 deductible. And absent this specific provision, there's nothing else in the compensation statutes that would prohibit the employer from going against the employee and taking back every dollar of benefit.
Well, Mr. Levenger answered the question. There is a statute, 415, which is a similar prohibition against going back for premiums and costs on the front end. But with the creation of a deductible plan, there is a new opportunity for bad employers to put pressure on injured employees to recoup those the expenses, the deductible. So, in answer to your question, I think it filled a need. There was a need created by the deductible plans to protect the employees from employers who might try that thing.
The deductible was a different element that was not specifically covered by the statute, and this was designed to cover that particular element.
Yes, Your Honor. There was a risk there that they foresaw as they were negotiating through the creation of this statute and the creation of these plans. They said, this is a good idea, but there is going to be the opportunity that at the end of the day, the employer is going to have to come up with some money. We don't want them applying pressure to the employees, and especially the injured employees, to recoup that money. That's going to be the deal, is that at the end of the day, if they can't get it from a responsible third party, then they are going to have to pay it. So it was filling a specific need.
But it also applies to, I assume, situations where the employer itself is negligent and there is no third-party claim. They're at that deductible.
That is correct. That is correct.
So you're saying that's the way we can read the two statutes together to prevent an absurd result, is that 5.55C was only intended to apply in when there's no third-party claim available.
When there's no third-party claimant or when the recovery from the third party is not sufficient to cover ultimately the employer's responsibility for repayment of the deductible amount.
Well, how do you answer their argument that under the subrogation scheme, under this kind of policy, that the employer is not defined as an entity that can seek subrogation as a carrier could and does?
Well, our answer is that the way that the legislature created this system to work and the way that the policies are put, the contracts are put together, interpreted, approved by the insurance department, is such that the benefits payment program works the same way as all the other policies. There was no sea change. That the insurance companies are responsible for the upfront payment of that, those expenses.
Mr. Whistler, you keep saying that, but we're obviously struggling with the fact that we have some specific language in the statute that we have to deal with if we were to rule your way. And we have a provision in the statute in which this type of an employer is not listed as a person with subrogation rights. So, I mean, as a matter of statutory construction and looking at the plain language of the tax statute, I mean, I think we're just asking for help in terms of how would we deal with that?
Well, in the answer that
we've
given...
You're off over here talking about all these other things, but we have in front of us plain language of a statute. We've got three provisions that we have to look at that seem to cut against you based on the plain language. So I think the reason why we keep going back, each of us keeps going back to that question, is we're asking you how would we deal with the plain language of the statute?
I think the plain language of the statute is that, and the answer is that 417 did not change. There was no change to those statutes, that the rights that the legislature gave to insurers did not change by the introduction of deductible plans, that insurers were entitled to expect that they were going to operate in the subrogation scheme the same way they always had. They were going to pay out benefits, and they were going to have a right to assert claims against responsible third parties to the extent that they had paid out benefits.
Plus the right to exert a claim against the employer for the deductible amount if what they paid out exceeds that.
If the recovery is insufficient.
Well, and Mr. Levenger points out that...
No, but even if it's sufficient, isn't it right that here Argonaut should be or has been repaid the $250,000 deductible?
Well, our argument and what the trial court did was grant us a recovery of the full amount of the lien, $362,000. Mm-hmm. $250,000 of that represents the deductible amount. So because we were able to recover all the benefits that were paid out, then there would be no recourse against the employer because the responsible third party has been responsible, has responded in damages and covered all of that.
But you all have already explained to us, though, that the way this particular scheme works is that the deductible is not paid on a per-claim basis. Periodic payments are made. So, in fact, while you've been paying out benefits at the same time, Argonaut's been receiving periodic payments from Flowers. So, in fact, under the way that scheme works, which is a little bit different, the carrier's not out anything at this point in terms of needing to go recover benefits that it has paid because it's already been paid by the employer for that.
Mr. Levenger is interpreting periodic payment as meaning beginning immediately. We're not reading it that way. The problem there was that the legislature did not want the insurance companies at the end of the day going and saying, Flowers Construction, now please write us a $250,000 check. That isn't going to be helpful to a small employer. So they're saying, when it comes time due to pay, then you spread it out. The periodic payments means payments spread out over time, but it does not necessarily mean beginning immediately upon payment.
Are you saying the record in this case shows that Flowers never paid anything on this deductible to
Argonaut? I don't recall that there's any evidence in the record that Flowers has begun to repay anything.
Is there any evidence either way?
The only evidence, Your Honor, is the contract, which says that the insurance company will go after the responsible third parties, and after deducting what could be recovered, that's how you calculate what the deductible repayment will be. Getting back to the point that, by definition, the deductible that the employer would owe, if any, can't be understood.
So unlike if I have a car accident and I need to get my car repaired, I'm going to have to pay my deductible and then get the insurance carrier to pay for the rest of my damage to the car. Under these particular plans, the carriers are footing the bill for the large deductibles over a long period of time without asking for any payment from the employer for the deductible in the interim, waiting to see if there's a third-party recovery?
That's my understanding of the way that it works, just under the terms of the contractual agreement between the parties that the insurance company says.
You can't tell us one way or another, and the record does not reflect that that's what's happened in this case or that that's what ordinarily happens.
I will tell you, Your Honor, I don't know how that has worked in this case. I have no information that Flowers Construction has ever been asked to repay.
Section D of your rider agenda that requires the insurance company to pay the employer back the deductible if enough is recovered from the third party. Were those provisions approved by any state agency?
It was my understanding, Your Honor, that in the workers' compensation context, you can't have a form, but all workers' compensation forms have to be on forms that are approved by the governmental authority with that responsibility.
So who approved this particular provision?
I believe that it is the insurance department that has to approve those forms.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the first cause will take a brief recess.
All rise.